Well, good morning, or shall I say sabah khair. Greetings from the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, from the dig of Sodom. I know when you woke up this morning, really early, the first thought that must have come into your mind this morning was, you know what, I need a really, really good biblical geography fix. Right? I mean, it's just, you woke up with geography on your mind, and maybe a thought of archaeology after that, but that's what we're going to get into today, and I want to share with you the very exciting discovery of Sodom, and the reason it's exciting is because so many scholars today, in fact, I always tell people, you know, I hang around with all the Near Eastern scholars, and we're friends, and we know them, but I promise you that, for example, most of the Israeli scholars, I'd say 80, 90% of the Israeli archaeologists don't believe that Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and Joshua were real people. It's just the way it is today. We're going to get into a little bit of an attack on that position. And I want to show you, let's get through some of this. I want to show you the important stuff. Here it is, digsodom.com. That takes you to our website. But here's another one that you need to load in to your phone. If you will text dig Sodom, one word, to the number 22828, what that will do is give you an instruction to enter your email address, and that will put you on the Tal al-Hamam Excavation Project email update list. We send several emails out a month, keeping you up with what's happening. You know, when a new set of radiocarbon dates comes in or a new discovery comes in, we update you on that. But during the dig season, from late January through early March, during that dig season, we send out an update every single day with photographs and descriptions of what's being discovered, so you can follow for 8 weeks the entire excavation day by day by day. So it's a lot of fun, very educational for your kids. And if you're homeschooling especially, you can sit down every day. It's, oh, let's find out what's going on in Jordan at the excavation and check in, and it's wonderful. So do that, and also get a hold of this. Now Jarrett did say, if you're interested, you are interested. I promise you, you are interested. This is one of the best books you will ever, ever read. It's the number one bestseller. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And I don't even know how that happened. But anyway, we're going to have those for sale out there. And it's a marvelous book. Dr. Latane Scott made it readable. The way I wrote it, it was totally unreadable. And I just give her the facts, and then she turns it into something that's very exciting. So get a copy of that book. You will absolutely love it. They're normally $26, special deal for you today, $20. So you can grab those out there. The other thing that's exciting, it took us 18 years for me to approve this thing and actually go to publication with it. We have the biblical timeline of the ancient Near East. It is really, really a cool deal. It has everything you ever need to know about all the kingdoms, all the Near Eastern kings and the Israelite kings and the books of the Bible and the Bible characters all throughout for all the history of the Bible. And on the other side, a thumbnail sketch of every archaeological period and biblical period, linking the Near Eastern history to the Bible history. It's just fantastic. Those are $20. If you buy 10, they become $10. If you buy 9, they're $20 each. If you buy 10, they're $10 each. Then you can scalp them to your friends. So, little fundraising opportunity for you there. So, anyway, check that out. You will love that. It folds up. It's laminated. It folds up. Fits right in your Bible. So if you ever want to just see where you are as you read the Bible, it's just fantastic. All right. I'm distressed to announce to you that we no longer live in a Bible-friendly world. Have you realized that? You kind of sense that? Yeah. Christianity has lost the culture. And we did it because we allowed scholars who are in our seminaries, our Bible colleges, who are training our kids to speak untruth, to give them alleged facts that really don't exist, to tell them that the Bible is really not true, that Moses really didn't write the Torah, that so much of the Bible is simply fiction. And I don't believe it. Now, I don't believe it simply because I'm a Christian, because I have faith. I believe the Bible is historically true because I think the facts are on the side of that case. And I'm going to show you a little bit of this. But let me give you a couple of quotes here just to reinforce this idea, this world we're in. By the way, I picked this particular book up. It's called Prelude to Israel's Past. I picked this book up in a Christian Bible bookstore. And look what it says. The patriarchal narratives are fiction, not reality. That world does not represent a real world. It stands outside the usual representation of time and space. As a matter of fact, neither the narratives nor their world can be dated to any precise period. Israel Finkelstein, the top Israeli archaeologist. Combination of archaeological and historical research demonstrates that the biblical account of the conquest and the occupation of Canaan by the Israelites is entirely divorced from historical reality. Now, this is what people get today. How do we fight this? There are many minimalists. A minimalist is a person who believes the minimal amount of history is in the Bible, the minimal amount of facts. They dismiss as much as they possibly can get away with. There are a lot of these guys who believe that you should not use the Bible in archaeology at all. They want to do archaeology for archaeology's sake, dismiss the biblical text completely. Here's one of them. William Deaver, sort of considered the dean of American Syro-Palestinian archaeologists. By the way, I've had Deaver come and lecture to my students, just not on Abraham. But he said this. They did an article on us, a top of the fold Wall Street Journal article, front page, a few years ago, and they dragged Bill Deaver into this to criticize me. And here's what he says. He says, "No responsible scholar goes out with a trowel in one hand and a Bible in the other." Well, okay. Here's what I said back in that article. "No responsible scholar digging in the Holy Land goes out without a trowel in one hand and a Bible in the other, and I'll tell you why. Because the Bible, worst case scenario, the Bible still remains the best geographical / historical source we have surviving from antiquity." Period. End of story. Okay? Bottom line. Okay. So, the existence and the location of Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain is a perfect test case for the reliability of the Bible. And it is that for at least three reasons. The first reason is that, as I said, most scholars, including a lot of the archaeologists, historians, and theologians, seriously doubt or dismiss the existence of these cities altogether. They just said they're mythical, they don't exist. In fact, when Bill Deaver, and I promise he'll do it again in a few weeks when I'm at the ASOR meetings in Denver, we'll be walking through the hallway, I'll say, "Hi, Bill." He'll say, "Still digging for Abraham, are you?" And I know what my answer is, as same as every year, "Found him, we did." Okay. But anyway, some people just dismiss it altogether. It's fiction to them. Second is, a lot of scholars who do believe the Bible and who do believe that these cities actually existed have placed them toward the south end of the Dead Sea. I promise you, every Bible dictionary, Bible encyclopedia that you look at is going to put them toward the south end of the Dead Sea. But as you will see before we're finished this morning, that is completely in error. So we need to get it in the right place. And the third thing is, if a legitimate, and I underscore the word here, legitimate, because there's a lot of pseudo-archaeology, a lot of scammers and hoaxers and hucksters out there putting a bunch of stuff out about biblical archaeology and Mount Sinai in Arabia and chariot wheels in the Red Sea and all of that's absolute nonsense. Go to the real archaeology. If you want to know what the real archaeology is, come meet me at the table afterward and we'll hook you up with it. But legitimate archaeology, if a legitimate, scientifically rigorous investigation into the whereabouts of these cities can actually succeed in finding them, and I would append to that, and actually demonstrate not only do they exist, but they were destroyed by fire out of the sky exactly as the Bible describes, if we can do that, then what will we have accomplished? We will have confirmed the historicity of the Bible. Okay? So we have the most doubted book in the Bible, Genesis. One of the most doubted books in the Bible in Genesis is what? The story of Sodom and Gomorrah. If we can demonstrate that that is true, it's factual, it happened exactly as the Bible describes it, then we have gone a long way to demonstrating the historical character of Scripture. Now, how do we do that? It's very simple. By the way, going into this, I would say this. As I drove into California, which I didn't, I flew in, but had I been driving, if I had stopped at the border, first little gas station I saw as I crossed into California, and I bought a road map of California, and I took that road map and I opened it up, and I looked at it and I said, oh, look at this, Los Angeles, wow. Now, I was born there, but I'm assuming I'm coming for the first time. Wow. And I looked at the road map and I followed the instructions given to me by the road map, and all of a sudden, as I drove over the valley and I looked, wow, Los Angeles. Now, in that scenario, would I be attributed with the discovery of LA? No. Now, people always say, oh, you're the guy that discovered Sodom. No. I'm the guy that followed the biblical roadmap to Sodom, and it was there. Okay, so I can't really be attributed with discovering Sodom anymore. I could be attributed to discovering LA with a good roadmap. Now, so we're gonna do three things. How do we find Sodom? Three things. Right, it's gotta be in the right place. We gotta look for the right time, and it's gotta have the right stuff. I love the word stuff because it covers everything. Right place, what do we mean by that? This is the geographical argument for the cities of the plain. This is going straight to the Bible because it is the Bible that talks about Sodom. It's the only document from antiquity that we find that actually talks about Sodom. So here it is, Genesis 13. Now, why Genesis 13? Because there is only one passage of Scripture in the whole Bible that is specifically meant consciously by the author to take us to the location of Sodom. Just one. This is it. Somebody, after I spoke yesterday at a conference, somebody came up after us, but there's Ezekiel 16. Oh, look, it says Sodom was south of... No, you can't use that passage, and I'll talk to you about that later. That's in a poetic passage. It's not a historical passage. This is a historical passage, and it is specifically written to take us to Sodom. So Genesis 13 is the primary text, and so let's do it. Here it is. Now, I've cut out the incidentals. That is everything but pretty much but the geography. So here's the geography distilled down from Genesis 13, the first 12 verses. So Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev. Lot went with him. From the Negev, he went from place to place until he came to Bethel, to the place between Bethel and Ai. Lot looked up, saw the whole plain of the Jordan, was well watered, like the garden of Yahweh, like the land of Egypt, toward Zoar. So Lot chose for himself the whole plain of the Jordan, set out toward the east. Abram lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot lived among the cities of the plain and pitched his tent near Sodom, or as the Hebrew says, Ad Sodom, as far as Sodom. Now, in this passage, you will see three times the word plain is given. Now, what's interesting about this word is it doesn't mean plain. The Hebrew word does not mean plain. It's not even in a possible translation of this word. So why do scholars do it? I don't know. Why do they translate some of the Bible like they do? Because they have a preconceived idea. The word here is simply this. It is the word kikar. Now, what does kikar mean? Kikar is found, by the way, 68 times in the Old Testament. 55 times of the 68 times it's found in the Old Testament, it just simply means a flat circular disc of metal. We call it a talent. Remember talents? of gold and so on, a talent of metal, flat circular disc, or a flat circular loaf of bread, aka tortilla. Okay, so what does kikar mean? Talents or tortillas? It's a circular place. 13 times out of those 68 times in the Bible, it refers to a geographical location, and a geographical location that is circular. At the south end of the Jordan Valley, you see the Jordan River coming down there into the Dead Sea. There, it widens out. It comes down about 10, 11 kilometers wide and then widens out in a big circular area about 30 kilometers in diameter north of the Dead Sea. It is HaKikar, the disc of the Jordan. And what's interesting is that the Jordan River, which brings all the fresh water down from the north, Jordan means the descending or the descent. Descent of what? Fresh water. All right? The Bible also says that the Jordan River terminates at the mouth of the Dead Sea, the Bay of the Dead Sea, at the mouth of the Jordan below Pisgah or Mount Nebo. Now, you can look at the geography here. It's all at the north end of the Dead Sea. And by the way, if the descending reaches the lowest spot on the face of the earth, which is the Dead Sea, do you suppose that it ends? You can't descend any further than that. Hayarden, the Jordan, means the descent, and it can only be north of the Dead Sea. So if Sodom is one of the cities of the Kikar, and these are the cities of the Jordan Kikar, then it can only be north of the Dead Sea, as we shall see. Now, the Jordan Kikar is well-watered, according to Genesis 13, two ways. One, like the Garden of Yahweh. How was that watered? It says a river ran through it. A river. And what river runs right down the middle of the Kikar? The Jordan. So it's split right down the middle by a river, just like the Garden of Yahweh in Genesis 2. But he says it's also watered like Egypt. Now, who wrote the book of Genesis? Moses. Where did Moses grow up? Egypt. Do you think he would recognize a hydrological similarity between the Jordan that overflows its banks every year, once a year, and the Nile, which overflows its banks every year in exactly the same way? The Jordan River is a Nile in miniature, hydrologically. So he looks at this and he says, oh, it's watered like Egypt. By the way, where did Moses write most of the Torah? Right there. Plains of Moab, right where Sodom had been located. So he's watching this geography before his eyes. It's watered like Egypt. Annual inundations depositing silt. They plant behind the receding waters and the newly deposited silt, and this drives the civilization of the southern Jordan Valley, just like the same phenomenon drove the Nilotic civilization in Egypt for over 3,000 years. All right, so fair observation by Moses. Here's what happens. It overflows. And by the way, how well watered is this place? Now we have the overflowing of the Jordan represented here in the Kikar. We have a spring at Jericho. The stars represent springs. And because there's one spring on the west side of the river there, and that's why Jericho is the only Bronze Age city on that side of the river. On the other side, we have many springs. In fact, I couldn't put enough stars in there. Because the entire Transjordan Aquifer disgorges geologically right there in the valley. And so they don't even need rain. They have all the water they need without rain, thus another similarity to Egypt. Now, so we have the best watered agricultural land in the entire region represented in the southern Jordan Valley. Now further, Genesis 13 says that Lot could see the entire circle or kikar of the Jordan from the area where he was standing. Where was he standing? At Bethel and Ai. Now, let me show you. Now, this north is toward the left here. You can see the length of the Dead Sea. And let's locate the two traditional sites of Sodom and Gomorrah for a lot of people down there in the south. Now, let's put in Bethel and Ai. There's Bethel and Ai. I know Bethel and I well. I excavated there for 6 years. And you can't see toward the south end of the Dead Sea from there. You can't. What you can see is that. And when you look at that, you can see the Kikar. This is what Lot was able to see. Okay, so let's lock that piece of the geography down. Well, from there, it says, he traveled eastward. not in the other direction, eastward. So let's look at it again. Here's Bethel and Ai. Lot travels eastward and pitches his tent as far as Sodom. That's the direction. It never says he went any other direction. Didn't turn to the north, didn't turn to the south. Only went eastward as far as Sodom. So Lot travels that way. He travels eastward. Therefore, Sodom can only be there. And by the way, why is Jericho up away from the river and why is Sodom up away from the river? Because of the inundations, the flooding. That river that will go out 5-6 kilometers on each side of the river in antiquity in the flood stage. And so you have to build your city away. And all the cities in the area confirmed that because they're built away from the river. It cannot be in the Dead Sea Valley, period. End of discussion. Now, the geography is easy. The map is easy. What about the right time? Why is the right time important? Because Abraham belongs to the Middle Bronze Age. He belongs to the Middle Bronze Age culturally. He belongs to the Middle Bronze Age in every way we can study him from the biblical text. And here it is. The early Bronze Age is about there, the Middle Bronze Age there, and Abraham and Lot belong to the Middle Bronze Age for sure. The cities of the plain in Genesis 10, going way back, belong to the early Bronze Age, the time of the first urbanization, the building of the first great walled cities. So we know when all that takes place. So if you're going to find Sodom, it better have strata from the early Bronze Age and from the Middle Bronze Age. If it lacks either one of those things, you don't have Sodom. And so we have to be in the right place, but we also have to be in the right time frame. And the right time frame for Sodom is that, according to the Bible. Now, let's go back to our map. And I've drawn in here for you the trade routes of the area. Now, look at that nice big set of that big intersection right there. If you saw the intersection without anything on the map, what would you suspect? Big intersection like that, what's there? A 7-Eleven, what, you know? It's like, there's a city there, and that's Jericho. Now look on the other side of the river. Isn't that interesting? Did you know that not a single, and I'll show you some in a minute, not a single American, Israeli, a European archaeological map of this area shows a single city on the west side, on the east side opposite Jericho. It's blank. But anybody looking at this and understanding the roots that are in the area would see this and go, oh, there must be something there. Well, in fact, there is. Look at this. There is a gigantic site. In fact, we know from all the, before we ever started the excavation, we saw this from the surveys, archaeological surveys that have been done in Jordan, that the largest ruin in the entire Jordan Valley sits at that intersection. It had never been excavated. Why? We still don't know. Well, we speculate, but guess what is around it? Other tells, other ancient sites all around it. In fact, there's so many of them, we had to name some new ones because they had never been seen before, never been documented before. And so now this is what it looks like. But guess what? Every single one of these has an Arabic name assigned to it. And so here we have the tells in the area. But the biggest one in the center of all of that civilization is Tal el Hamam. So let me introduce you to her. We call her because God calls her in Ezekiel 16. Tal el Hamam. This is the largest archaeological ruin in the entire Jordan Valley. And guess what? It has a fabulous early Bronze Age city. It has an equally fantastic intermediate Bronze Age city, and it has an equally or even more wonderful Middle Bronze Age city from the time of Abraham, the Middle Bronze Age. So, right place, right time frame. What about the right stuff? Well, we could really spend a lot of time on this, but we don't have it, but let's just do one. Genesis 19:1 says, Lot sat in the gateway of Sodom. By the way, if you come on any of our Bible Land expeditions with us, we will seat you exactly where Lot sat at the bench in the gateway of Sodom. Pretty cool. Is Sodom fortified? You have a gate, you have a fortification. Bible says Sodom is a big fortified city. Is it fortified? Here's the early bronze city wall from Genesis 10. It is 18 feet thick and encloses 62 acres. In the same period, how big is Melchizedek's Jerusalem? Or not same period, a little bit later. 10 acres, Melchizedek's Jerusalem. How big is Jericho? 10 acres. How big is Sodom? 62 acres inside the city wall with another 150 acres outside. It's unbelievable. Here's my wife and I standing atop the defensive rampart of the upper city, which is completely made of mud brick. That's just not a bunch of dirt piled up there. It's 60 to 100 million individually made and laid mud bricks to create the ramparts around the city, not even including the city wall. Here are the southern defenses. That's the early Bronze Age city wall. Then the middle Bronze Age wall constructed at a certain point in history over the top to build a bigger and better fortification. There's the entrance into that exterior tower. Here's the interior of the tower. You can see that there's columns in this version of the tower. Here's Lane Rittenmeyer's reconstruction drawing. This is the gate of Sodom. Isn't that fantastic? You actually look at, wow, what does the gate of Sodom look like? There's what it looks like. Not only that, here's the city of Sodom. We're just entering our 14th year of excavation at Sodom. We know where the walls are. We know where the towers are. We know where the temples are. We know where the palace is. And right now we're excavating the palace, and it's fantastic. The palace walls at Sodom are 1 meter to 2 meters thick. That's huge. The palace was at least three stories tall. It's very exciting. Now, I just want to give you a quickie review. I'm watching my time clock carefully, so we're counting down. I want to give you a quick run through of the season 13 excavations, which we just finished about six months ago now. And here we are. You see the circle, and that is the palace area excavation. Let's tighten down on it. Tighten down a little more. And you can see the palace excavation. There it is. And now let's go inside the excavation from this past season. We are excavating in the palace of Sodom from the Middle Bronze Age. And here is, look at this destruction layer. Everything in that area right there, this is always a meter to a meter and a half of nasty, ugly destruction debris over the entire site. And nothing was built on top of it for over 700 years that it remained a blank. And so just taking you through the palace. By the way, now what's exciting about that? Do you get excited about rocks? You know what's exciting about this pile of rocks? This is a doorway in the palace of Sodom. King, you know from the Bible the personalities that walk through this door. Abraham walked through this door. Lot probably walked through this door. King Bera of Sodom himself walked through this door many times. This is in his house, his palace. So it's fantastic to see these things. Here's the palace from the part of the palace. We've only opened about a very fraction of it so far, but there it is. And I want to show you something here. You see those? There's four storage jars there full of grain, barley to be exact. Do you notice that they're not sitting on a floor? They're all up in the destruction matrix. This is what we find across the entire site. Everything at the site, the pottery, the bits of people, every artifact, they are all, and the mud bricks are all airborne and landing in a jumble. We call it the Cuisinart effect. Put anything in the Cuisinart, what happens when you hit the button? That's what the destruction matrix of Sodom looks like. Meter and a half of it. By the way, so, well, shouldn't it be thicker than that if these buildings were three stories tall? Yes. But guess what? It was all blown away in the destruction, which we shall see shortly. So here's some excavating, cooking pot, some more pottery. We never find anything complete in the excavation of Sodom. Why? Because of the way it was destroyed. It was literally exploded away. And so we find very little complete, bottom of a nice jar, still full of grain. We wash the stuff up, we put it in drying trays, it dries, and then we take it to the reading table and we read every single diagnostic shirt, rim, handle, base, those kinds of things. And gentleman on the left, Dr. Craig Olson, on the right, Dr. Mohammed Najjar, who is Jordan's top archaeologist, who has just, he came to me this last season and he said, I must join your excavation. He's writing a paper for a major conference in Florence, Italy, which I'll also be attending because I'm presenting a paper there as well. The title of his paper is this, Reinterpreting the Transjordan Bronze Age in the Light of Tal el-Hammam. That's how important our site is, not just Sodom, but for the whole history of the Near East. And so Dr. Najjar is now part of our team. Here's Camel One, our great Mitsubishi pickup truck, which those who support our excavation were able to buy us last year. We love it. And after the season closes down, we pack our tools up in Camel One, haul it down to the mosque at the base of the hill where we store our equipment, and we put the fence back up and the sign back up that says, keep out. All right. Now, you say, oh, that's wonderful. Oh, very exciting. Ho-hum. We want to know how the thing was destroyed. We want the juicy stuff. How bad was it? Did it kill everybody? Yes, in fact, it did. Terms of destruction, here it is. Now, what's interesting, putting back up the map here, you can see all of these roadways going out from the Kikar, and they all go somewhere. They go to En Gedi or Hebron or Jerusalem or Jericho or Pella or to Gilead on the other side or to Ammon and so on. And all of those areas around it continue on into the next archaeological period. In other words, there's no break in civilization. Everything just continues on as normal, except for something very interesting. How many of those late Bronze Age sites from the next archaeological period after Abraham, how many of those sites exist in the Kikar of the Jordan on the east side of the river, where the cities of the plain existed? Zero. Why? Because they were all completely destroyed, the entire civilization, 400 square kilometers, taken out in less time than that. And nobody lived there for the next 700 years. Here's some facts. When you get facts, you have to make inferences. And so here's a fact. Bronze Age civilization on the Eastern Jordan Disc, with Tal el-Hammam as its cultural center, flourished for over 2,500 years continuously without a break. Fact, this same civilization, including Sodom or Tal el-Hammam, came to an abrupt termination toward the end of the Middle Bronze Age. Remember, that's time of Abraham. And it remained unoccupied for at least the next seven centuries. That's amazing. It's the best watered agricultural land in the region. How does the best watered land remain without people for the next seven centuries? Well, how bad was the destruction is what we're saying. Here's the critical question. Why did this best watered agricultural land remain without cities and towns for the next seven centuries following its destruction? Well, I'll show you. There's the destruction from the MB2, and there's a full meter of ash and destruction debris. By the way, there's a Solomonic period, a 10th century fortification on top of it from much later, from 700 years later. And as we dig down through it and we hit the Middle Bronze Age on the upper city, we found this particular sherd of pottery. It really bothered me because when you flip this sherd of pottery over, it's from the shoulder of a large storage jar. When you flip it over, the outside is melted into glass. The clay itself is melted into glass. When I first saw this, I went, oh my goodness, what is a piece of this glazed Islamic 6th, 7th century AD pottery doing down here? Well, it wasn't, because glaze wasn't invented until the 7th, 8th century AD. But it looked glazed, but when we looked at it closely, we went, oh, this is not glazed at all. It's melted. It's melted. And then we took it and had it analyzed. Well, here's what comes up in the analysis. You see, this blackish material is carbon being separated out from the melted silica, from the clay body itself. And then there's another elemental separation. This is calcium being separated out in little nodules that are remaining in the glass. This only happens at extremely high temperatures. The internal temperature, with our testing, the internal temperature of the zircons in the center of this, not even in the glass, in the middle of this clay body, away from the melt, those zircons were boiled. And you know what temperature it takes to boil a zircon? 3,800 degrees Celsius. And that's inside the pottery. That's not even on the melted surface. So this thing got really toasty. We estimate somewhere between 15 and 25,000 degrees Fahrenheit for less than that, a millisecond. Now, what's interesting about this photograph is that on the left, we have the Middle Bronze Age pottery sherd. On the right, by the way, we have a lot of this material now, even melted mud bricks. On the right is trinitite from ground zero of the first atomic bomb explosion in New Mexico. They are identical. In fact, when I handed the sherd first time to the PhD geologist doing the testing of this the very first time, she held this in her hand and she said, "Oh, nice piece of trinitite." She was an expert in it. "Nice piece of trinitite. Where did you get it?" "Never mind, just do the test." Now, they knew where it was from, but it's interesting. It's materially identical to trinitite. Now, some people have gone out of these talks saying, "Dr. Collins said Sodom was destroyed by a nuclear bomb." No, that's not what I just said. I said that heat index is similar or even exceeding that of an atomic explosion. Okay, that's all we're saying. There's no radiation. There's no atomic bombs. This is all accomplished in a very different way, in fact, exactly as the Bible describes it. Here's some desert glass. This is coming from very nearby. This is a piece of mud brick that is melted, is from the site, that is melted into green glass. And we have tons of this stuff now. Here's what was destroyed. Here's some houses. I just thought you'd want to see a house. Bits and pieces of people exploded in the strata. Little bump, pieces of human bone scatter. Toys, wheel of a little cart. Jewelry, pottery, beautiful pieces of pottery. Bronze necklaces and so forth. Scarabs from the Hyksos period, the time of Abraham. And lots of this black, nasty ash. Now, we now call this, we've had for several years, almost 5 years now, a team of a dozen or so scientists working on the airburst event at Tal Hamam. They now call it, it's officially now going into the literature as the 3.7 Ka 1000 annum BP. In other words, 3,700 years ago, 1,700 BC, Kikar event. And here is the site. What's interesting is we have noted that there is little or no mud brick on the southwest part of the site. It's like the large stone foundations are just scoured clean of their mud brick superstructures. So all that adobe material is just literally blown off its foundations. But right there is a 100-foot-high defensive rampart. Now, it actually rings the entire upper city. But that portion of the rampart would have blocked an object coming in from the southwest, and behind that we find mud brick surviving up to the top of the rampart. Above the rampart, it was literally sheared off and blown away. Now, what does that mean? It means that the direction of the object that came in was coming from the southwest, and it blew everything to the northwest. This is down inside the palace, and you see everything moving to the northwest. That's what that arrow represents. Now, right there is a saddle kern, that big stone you see. And you see how smooth it is on the left side? It's all worn down nicely. Well, that's supposed to sit upright. It's like a big grinding stone for grinding grain. It's over 400 pounds in weight. Yet, the force of the blast tipped it over on its side, and we have literally the grain that fell off of it and moving across the floor, also with hundreds and hundreds of pottery vessels. okay? A powerful blast moving everything in a northwesterly direction. I'm sorry, northeasterly direction. Now, here it is. That's the kikar, and I want to show you a little bit of what happened. It came from the southwest, and it explodes there. What is it? Here's another angle. It comes out of the sky from the southwest, approximately 1 kilometer from the ground. It explodes and completely decimates 400 square kilometers of civilization in the blink of an eye. What is it? It's an airburst event. You can read about it. We have a nice description of it in the book. It is now being published in major scientific journals, and very exciting stuff. The liberals are going to have so much fun with this. Not. It's going to be interesting to see how they explain it. So, let's wrap this thing down. What happens when you ignore the biblical text in the case of the kikar geography? What happens when you ignore it? What have the liberals done? Ignore the Bible. Now, here's what happens. This is considered the best historical atlas or historical geography of the Holy Land in print by my good friend Anson Rainey, who's now deceased, but Anson was a terrific scholar. But look at this. Nothing there. That's where Sodom should be located. He has nothing. Why? Because he doesn't believe it exists. Here's another map. Here's his intermediate bronze site. Oh, he has Iktanu, which we now know is one of our many satellites, but basically there's nothing there. Let's go to the time of Abraham, the Middle Bronze Age. Look, nothing there. Blank. Now, here's the shocker for the scholars today. Here's what it should look like. Big difference. Blank to that. That's the biblical picture. And following the Bible and doing the archaeology and the science, that's what it should look like. Now, here's what we say. If in the past, archaeologists and Bible scholars had taken the Sodom tales seriously, they would have discovered this important civilization in the land of the Kikar a long time ago. But they didn't. And they didn't. But we did. And not so surprisingly, we did. Okay? All right. Now, I want to close with this. We have about 2 minutes. 7 quick things our project has demonstrated about the Bible, the importance of the Bible, the accuracy of the Bible. Number one, Sodom was in fact an extremely great city of the ancient world as reported to us in Genesis 10, where it's mentioned along with the great cities of Mesopotamia. Second, it was a large, wealthy city-state and had a lot of satellites around it. Yes, that's exactly what the Bible says, and guess what? That's exactly what we have discovered. Third thing, Sodom and the cities of the Kikar thrived during the time of Abraham in the Middle Bronze Age. And I'll just show you some of the palace pottery. It's just fantastic stuff. You could put it in a shop today, in a curio shop. People would love it. They'd buy it up. It's beautiful stuff. Sodom had roots in the Bronze Age, Minoan world. And I didn't go into this, but that little story about the attempted abduction of the angels, remember that? Yeah. That's all explained by the Minoan culture, which used homosexual ritual abduction as a part of its culture. But anyway, we've connected this site to the Minoan culture of Crete. We have this unique Minoan-style architecture. We have this pillared gateway, which is not found in Canaan, but it's found at our site. And we have a reconstruction of it. The light wells is typical of Minoan architecture. And of course, some of our ceramics have the down-horned bull, typical of the Minoans from Crete. So you see some of ours at the top and some of the ones from Crete on the bottom. We have this wonderful chalice that came out, actually incense burner. And you'll notice that at the bottom of it, there is what looks to be a proto-Ionic column with a capital on it. See that? That is purely Aegean in its form. So we've connected it up. Here's Aegean-style pottery being found at the site. The fifth thing, Sodom and the cities of the Kikar were destroyed violently during the time of Abraham. This is confirmed by the science. Archaeology absolutely tells us that this is not a myth. It is, in fact, the case, and we can test it. We take our carbon, have it carbon dated, and all other kinds of tests done. It was destroyed by a superheated plasmic impact produced by a meteoritic airburst, which is described in the 19th chapter of Genesis. Fire and goprit, not to be translated brimstone, fire and goprit, burning stone from Yahweh out of the heavens. It's exactly what happened. And of course, we showed you that. And the last thing, Sodom and the land of the Kikar remained uninhabited for 7 centuries after its divine destruction. And I want to show you, this is from a very scholarly article showing this. There's the point in time of Sodom's destruction. By the way, the chronology here is moving from left to right. So the farther to the right you go, the older you get, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years. There's the destruction of Sodom. What happened? These are the levels of the Dead Sea. The climate changed. This event was so drastic that it caused or participated in a major climate shift. Look what happens. Over the next barely 100 years, the level of the Dead Sea drops from its historic high to its historic low. Stopped raining. In other words, it was a really bad time in that part of the world because of the destruction of the evil cities in the Kikar, according to the book of Genesis. Well, I just say back to Dr. Deaver, the Bible and the trowel do work remarkably well after all, do they not? Thank you so much.